Another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 20th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: gross U.S. debt surpassed $40 trillion. The Treasury Department reported a new milestone in the country's struggle to control its finances. Government bond yields fell sharply after the Treasury Department said it would at least double the size of its buyback program for longer-term debt. Stocks rose, with the S&P 500, Dow, and NASDAQ all ticking up 0.2%. More Fed officials favored raising interest rates last month than the three who formally dissented, and others signaled they would back an increase if inflation doesn't improve, minutes show. Amazon is expanding its drone delivery service with a planned increase from its current scope to nearly 500 cities and towns by year end. OpenAI promised not to retain data from businesses using its AI models while improving the safety of its products in a bid to snatch customers from rival Anthropic. Cantor Fitzgerald plans to give investment funds access to Kelsey's prediction markets, serving as a broker to those clients. Target again raised its fiscal year outlook as the retailer's turnaround takes shape and it draws in more customers. SK Hynix plans to buy back and cancel more than $28 billion of its shares over the next 3 months, accelerating its shareholder return program. Booming trading and listing activity in Hong Kong propelled the city's exchange operator to another record quarter, with net profit up 21%. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. An experimental mRNA-based vaccine succeeded in preventing cancer from coming back or spreading in a study of high-risk melanoma patients, its developers said. The Army is phasing out its drone assault battalion months after its formation as part of a back-to-basics approach ordered by the service's acting chief of staff. The Israeli military said it was launching criminal investigations into two attacks by its soldiers on Palestinians during the Gaza War, including one that killed a young girl. The UAE suspended financial and economic transactions with Iran, potentially threatening its access to a major source of imports and a financial backdoor to the world. Trump said he would launch a major economic campaign against Iran as frustrations mount over the lack of progress on reopening the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. is likely to lower tariffs on Canadian steel, aluminum, and automobiles as part of a trade framework being devised by Washington and Ottawa. Prince Harry plans to return to the UK with his family 6 years after he and his wife Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, quit their royal duties and decamped to the U.S. West Coast. The FTC warned retailers against using consumers' personal data, including smartphone use, to calculate an individual's tolerance for higher prices. North Korea responded icily to Trump's decision to end joint Washington-Seoul military exercises early, calling it an ineffectual goodwill gesture toward Pyongyang. A Ukrainian man wanted in Germany in connection with the 2022 undersea explosions that damaged the Nord Stream gas pipelines was arrested on a European warrant in Croatia. The picture on today's front page shows a young man draped in the Ukrainian flag, clapping and appearing to be shouting. And that caption reads, "No pressure. Demonstrators backing Mykhailo Fedorov, Ukraine's ousted defense minister, protested Wednesday in Kyiv. Fedorov challenged President Volodymyr Zelensky, calling for elections and warning that democracy is imperiled." And the headline, "Challenger tests Zelensky's hold on power." The article, "Zelensky is facing new leadership threat," by Matthew Luxmore. Ukraine's ousted defense minister has triggered the biggest challenge to Volodymyr Zelensky's hold on the presidency since Russia's invasion, calling for wartime elections and warning Ukrainian democracy is imperiled. Mykhailo Fedorov, whose dismissal last month prompted anti-government protest, lambasted Ukraine's leadership and what he called a lack of democratic process in the country, in a video address urging changes to root out corruption, excessive bureaucracy, and cronyism. Adding to the pressure on Zelensky, hours later, investigators from Ukraine's anti-corruption unit conducted a series of raids as part of a probe into the activities of Ukrainian presidential officials, one of whom the president proceeded to fire. During his six-month tenure as defense minister, Fedorov was praised as an innovator who pushed against the Soviet mindset prevalent in parts of the armed forces and promoted the use of modern technologies such as drones and digital fixes to reduce bureaucracy. His 10-minute monologue, published Tuesday on YouTube, is being interpreted in Kyiv as the opening gambit in a potential run for the presidency. Martial law in Ukraine, imposed after Russia's 2022 invasion, prohibits elections. People cannot endlessly live in a state where they do not understand why certain decisions are made, why some reforms move forward while others are blocked, why decisions needed on the front lines today spend months circulating through government offices, Fedorov said. The broadside came on the eve of a vote in Ukraine's parliament to formalize the appointment of Yevheny Kamara as new defense minister, a move Fedorov opposed. Since his firing, several rounds of negotiations with Zelensky about his future have failed to land Fedorov a new role. Articles from the front page follow. U.S. debt eclipses $40 trillion. Latest figure as share of GDP nears levels not seen since World War II. By Sam Goldfarb and Matt Grossman. Gross U.S. debt has surpassed $40 trillion, a new milestone in the country's struggle to control its finances. The country's total public debt outstanding officially hit $40.047 trillion on Tuesday, the Treasury Department reported Wednesday, ticking up from $39.987 trillion a day earlier. Reaching that threshold carries symbolic weight, but isn't by itself economically significant. Most investors and economists care less about raw figures than other measures, like the ratio of debt to gross domestic product, which provides a better sense of an economy's borrowing capacity. And economists typically focus more on a different measure of government debt, that held by the public, which doesn't include debt held within the government in Social Security trust funds. That number was $32.266 trillion on Tuesday. Still, $40 trillion is a big number, likely to at least briefly draw attention to what economists broadly agree is an unsustainable fiscal trajectory. In recent days, rising long-term government borrowing costs and a sudden reversal Wednesday after the Treasury announced plans to buy back more long-term debt have underscored the stakes. Women at L3Harris Warned About CEO by Kara Lombardo, Marcus Weisgerber, and Drew Fitzgerald. It was a warning that was shared among women who worked for Chris Kubasik. Avoid being alone with the executive and be careful on the corporate jet. Multiple women at defense contractor L3Harris Technologies had raised concerns about Kubasik's behavior, including a formal complaint from one woman to Human Resources that was made around 2023, people familiar with the matter said. The employee accused the CEO of sexual harassment, the people said. Kubasik stayed on in his role. The women left L3Harris. Not all L3Harris board members were briefed on the 2023 complaint, and it is unclear whether the matter was formally investigated, the people said. Recently, the directors launched a probe into Kubasik after another accusation against him. The board hired outside lawyers and investigated allegations of inappropriate conduct with a subordinate and aggressive, profane behavior, people familiar with the board deliberations said. Kubasik was pushed out this week. L3Harris, without providing details, said the investigation found he had violated the company's code of conduct. The company said the CEO was leaving without severance. In his separation agreement, Kubasik didn't admit he violated policy or that there was a cause for termination. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Moderna, Merck shares SOAR on cancer vaccine success by Xavier Martinez and Alex Janin. An experimental mRNA-based vaccine succeeded in preventing cancer from coming back or spreading in a study of high-risk melanoma patients, Moderna and its partner Merck said Wednesday, paving the way for a potentially new life-extending treatment for the thousands of people diagnosed with the deadly skin cancer each year. Moderna shares more than doubled Wednesday to $174.38, while stock in Merck notched an all-time high, rising 12.6% to close at $152.20. It is the second big oncology breakthrough in recent months after a different drug succeeded in extending the lives of people with pancreatic cancer, a notoriously lethal disease. Melanoma has also traditionally been a very deadly cancer, but immunotherapies like Merck's Keytruda have made great strides in improving outcomes. Merck and Moderna's study looked at people who had surgery to remove a melanoma and were using the personalized cancer vaccine intismerin in combination with Keytruda to reduce the risk of it returning. The study met the main goal of extending the time before cancer returns in high-risk patients when compared with patients on Keytruda alone. The study also met a secondary goal of preventing the disease from spreading to different organs. Iron Bond, One Family, One Firm, 130 Years by Julia Chung, Chattanooga, Tennessee. On a humid June weekend, three generations of lodges descended on a Weston here. A family members now also bearing surnames like Kellerman, Millhiser, and Richards had flown and driven in from all around the country. There was the high school fencing coach from New Jersey and the aerospace engineer from Washington. There was a two-year-old toddler, the youngest of the reunion attendees, and an 88-year-old who joined for multiple scheduled events, including a ride up a mountain in a funicular railway. This wasn't a typical family reunion. The gathering coincided with the annual shareholder meeting of the Lodge Cast Iron Pan Company, which has been melting pig iron and recycled steel to form cast iron pans for 130 years. Most of the families have long since left nearby South Pittsburgh, Tennessee. Hardly any of them work at the company or in the factory itself, let alone could tell you much about the melting temperature of pig iron. But in an era of public offerings and rich acquisitions, this family has kept a tight grip on the handle of the business their patriarch founded in 1896. Diet drugs alter Big Food's winning recipe. With GLP-1's threatening sales, companies test ways to win over the not-so-hungry. By Amira McKee and Jesse Newman. Inside an Omaha test kitchen, executives at Conagra recently huddled over plastic trays of microwaved eggs, potatoes, and sausage. One by one, they lifted a package of cheese sauce and poured out the liquid in a slow orange ribbon. Ashley Lind, who heads behavior science at Conagra, studied the breakfast bowl in front of her. She considered, was it satisfying? No one had tasted the food yet. That was part of the point. Conagra is trying to design products that will entice even people who don't want to eat. The tasting was one of dozens of tests the maker of Slim Jims and Hungry Man Dinners is conducting, with an eye toward the conundrum presented by GLP-1 weight loss drugs. The medication's power to erase feelings of hunger and satiation threatens to upend the industry's model for growth, where success has often meant selling as much food as possible. For decades, food companies have relied on a proven playbook, catered to consumers' taste buds with sugar, salt, and a steadily expanding galaxy of flavors. Fine-tuning products to cravings and indulgence has led critics to accuse food makers of hooking consumers on food and snacks, the same way nicotine hooks smokers and fueling an obesity epidemic. But for America's biggest food makers, winning over GLP-1 users is a whole new challenge. As many as 55 million Americans, or 15% of the population, are expected to be on GLP-1 drugs by 2035, according to projections from Morgan Stanley. KPMG estimates users consume about one-fifth fewer calories while on medications. Leaving the front page, Army phasing out new drone unit. General LaNeve takes aim at cutting-edge battalion in a back-to-basics approach. By Michael R. Gordon and Laura Sigelman. The Army took a major step to prepare for wars of the future in January when it established a new battalion in Europe to master the art of fighting with drones and ground robots. The idea was to learn the lessons of the conflict in Ukraine that has been raging on NATO's doorstep and develop cutting-edge military systems and tactics to counter the Russian threat. But the much-touted drone assault battalion is being phased out. After participating in a major exercise in Germany in August and September, the unit will report its findings to the Army to guide future experimentation, shed its drone assault role, and refocus on its core warfighting tasks as an airborne infantry battalion, an Army official told the Wall Street Journal in a statement. The elimination of a futuristic drone battalion is part of a broader back-to-basics approach ordered up by General Christopher LaNeve, the acting chief of staff of the Army, who is closely aligned with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. The battalion was a signature initiative of LaNeve's predecessor, General Randy George, whom Hegseth ousted in April. The decision to wind down the drone assault unit is drawing criticism from several military experts who say it will slow down the Army's push to excel in the kind of drone warfare that has transformed the battlefield in Ukraine and the Middle East. Ukraine has essentially revolutionized the close fight, said Michael O'Hanlon, a defense expert at the Brookings Institute in Washington. General George was starting to get that, and any setback in what he was doing would be deeply regretful and dangerous. Trump threatens Iran with economic D-Day by Meredith McGraw and Phil Wegman. Washington. President Trump vowed to unleash what he called economic D-Day on Iran as frustrations mount over lack of progress on reopening the Strait of Hormuz or reaching a deal to end the nearly six-month war. Trump said on Wednesday evening he would launch a major economic campaign against Iran and any entity that does business with the regime. The president said it would be the most crushing economic operation ever taken against any country. Trump didn't say what specifically the U.S. would do in addition to the heavy sanctions that are already on Tehran. I am also announcing that any country that allows its financial institutions, businesses, airports, or government entities to provide any type of lifeline to Iran will itself face tremendous economic consequences, Trump posted on Truth Social. Oil smuggling, swap lines, cash transfers, exchange houses, ship registries, front companies, it all needs to stop now. You know who you are? The president called on U.S. allies to support his effort to isolate Iran. The White House didn't return a request for comment. China is Iran's largest trading partner in the Islamic Republic, has economic ties with Middle East neighbors, but trade with Europe is small after years of sanctions and other restrictions. As part of the U.S. strategy to squeeze Iran economically, the United Arab Emirates said late Tuesday that it has suspended financial and economic transactions with Iran, potentially threatening Tehran's access to a major source of imports and a financial backdoor to the world. OpenAI won't keep clients' data. ChatGPT maker hopes to win over customers upset with rival Anthropic by Amrith Rampkumar. OpenAI promised not to retain data from businesses using its artificial intelligence models while increasing the safety of its products, a bid to snatch customers from rival Anthropic, who are upset the maker of Claude is keeping their information. The ChatGPT maker said Wednesday that it was previewing new technology to some customers that let it detect patterns and safety risks across multiple interactions with its models. The goal is to move beyond previous AI safety systems that motivated interactions individually, which made it difficult to ensure tools were being used properly without retaining some customer data. The pledge stands in contrast to Anthropic's policy of keeping customer data for 30 days to ensure the safety of its latest models. The move has drawn criticism from tech leaders, including White House AI advisor and venture capitalist David Sachs, Microsoft chief executive Satya Nadella, and Palantir's Alex Karp, who have argued that businesses need certainty that AI companies aren't keeping their data, particularly in regulated industries such as healthcare and finance. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the opinion pages, Trump and the campuses, part two. Education Secretary Linda McMahon calls universities to action and some answer, by Barton Swaim. When a federal judge last week dismissed President Trump's lawsuit against Harvard for violating the rights of Jewish students, most of the mainstream press reacted with glee and treated the judge's reasoning with minimal curiosity. U.S. District Judge Richard G. Stearns agreed to dismiss a lawsuit on grounds that the administration failed to prove that institutionalized noncompliance continued after the 2023-24 school year, which strikes me as akin to a judge tossing a criminal indictment because the defendant stopped his illegal activity on arrest. An appeal could stretch past Mr. Trump's term, which, as this newspaper's editorial board noted, may have been the strategy all along. That strategy could work, but not in the long term. Elite schools made themselves odious to the public by tolerating and intermittently condoning the vilest displays of anti-Semitic hooliganism. Ivy League schools were never popular with the public, but Mr. Trump's rough treatment of them became politically salable in a way it never could have been before the Hamas attacks that inspired the protest. The lunacy of America's top colleges has become a perpetual news item. The latest ballyhoo, Tyler Austin Harper's cover essay in The Atlantic, Confessions of a Token Black Professor. Mr. Harper recounts his first academic job at Bates College in Lewiston, Maine, and recounts his realization that the school's administrators and loudest faculty had given themselves to a variety of racist and otherwise deranged ideologies. But the most remarkable thing about the essay is that a similarly harrowing account could issue from nearly every elite campus in America, if only it contained someone who could write as well as Mr. Harper. In fact, Americans' opinions of higher education have crept steadily downward over the past decade. Grade inflation, reports of rampant cheating with chatbots, and an ever-gushing stream of stories about the Stalinist behavior of students, faculty, and DEI administrators. The headlines grow darker and more numerous all the time. Last October, the White House invited 9 institutions to sign what it called the Compact for Academic Excellence in Higher Education. Signatory institutions, the administration pledged, would get preferential tax breaks and fast-track access to loans, grants, contracts, and research funding. Institutions choosing not to sign would, by implication, risk getting the opposite. Some of the compact's principles, colorblind admissions, viewpoint diversity, civil discourse, institutional neutrality, recommend themselves. Others don't, chief among them a commitment to keep tuition flat for 5 years. Some schools have kept tuition low and don't deserve that penalty, and all have to deal with government-propelled inflation. Anyway, the compact failed. None of the 9 schools signed. The administration's second effort hasn't received the coverage it deserves. A crisply written letter from Education Secretary Linda McMahon this month appears to have more work behind it than the compact did, and sounds a more nuanced and generous tone. The letter, titled "A National Call to Action to University Presidents and Governing Boards," poses 7 questions. Ms. McMahon asks what colleges and universities are doing to ensure 1. Merit-based, non-racialist admissions. 2. A free and open sphere of inquiry. 3. Intellectual diversity in the faculty. And 4. Affordable tuition. The secretary would also like to know how schools intend 5. To address grade inflation and artificial intelligence. 6. Curb the influence of foreign governments. And 7. Promote U.S. security interest. Leave Mr. Trump out, and a large majority of Americans would agree that colleges and universities should probably have ready explanations on all 7 topics. But of course, you can't leave him out. The president's unpopularity with nearly everyone in higher education will tempt some university leaders to scorn Ms. McMahon's call to action. They can't be seen to work with her or her boss. But the readiness with which Mr. Trump has used force against top-tier universities has induced the wiser ones to read her letter with care and some to support it. Add the multiple investigations of universities by the Justice Department Civil Rights Division for racially discriminatory admissions policies, and college leaders have all the reason they need to pay attention. Jonathan Pidluzny, the Education Department's Deputy Chief of Staff, doesn't ignore the sticks, but emphasizes carrots. "This initiative isn't connected to funding consequences," he tells me. "We think that will probably make universities more likely to participate, and in time, we hope to remember this as a moment when things started to change." He confirms media reports that leaders from Arizona State, Johns Hopkins, the University of Kansas, and Washington University in St. Louis helped draft Ms. McMahon's call to action. The university systems of Florida and North Carolina have endorsed it and submitted detailed responses. Maybe the effort will amount to a lot of talk in the higher education sector, as it's terrifyingly known, will remain an expensive, unreformable blob. But Mr. Trump, for all his bad manners and lawlessness, has proved that even universities respond to the credible threat of force. Midterm lessons from Bush to Trump. Republicans lost worse in 2018 than in 2006. It doesn't have to happen this year. By Karl Rove. Minimalist architect Ludwig Mies van der Rohe believes less is more. What's true in aesthetics is true in politics sometimes too. President Trump's political handlers should keep that in mind this fall. You can imagine how Mr. Trump wants this campaign season to roll out. He wants to fly from rally to rally, inserting himself in the middle of every important contest. He's headed to South Carolina Friday, presumably to do just that. In battleground states and districts, the president will walk on stage to Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA, then launch into an hour plus of pontificating, warning of the dangers of the Democrats, and predicting nothing but death, squalor, poverty if these communists get elected. The crowds will go wild. He'll careen from one unrelated subject to another. He calls this the weave. The rest of us call it word salad. Each day, something he says, probably unscripted, will dominate that news cycle. It won't matter how unconnected it is to the candidate he's there to boost. A far better course would be to minimize the president's pontifical profile after Labor Day. Mr. Trump is unpopular. His approval in the Real Clear Politics average is 39%. A season of political rallies won't improve that. Less campaigning might. It makes no sense to help Democrats more easily tie a Republican candidate to voters' low opinion of Mr. Trump. Get the president to raise money at private fundraisers, but avoid high-profile rallies in battlegrounds that will only energize an already excited Democratic electorate and make it more difficult for Republicans to contrast themselves with their opponents. I know of what I speak. In 2006, President George W. Bush was unpopular. His Gallup approval rating on November 1st was 38%, and the public had soured on the Iraq War. So while he raised oodles of campaign cash at private fundraisers, his campaigning was limited. He went only where his presence would help. His first public fall campaign event was in deeply conservative southern Indiana on October 28th. He then appeared in South Carolina, Montana, Georgia, Nebraska, Kansas, Colorado, and Florida, before closing out with an Election Eve rally in Dallas. His messages were geared to big issues, the tone restrained. We weren't looking to make news. By lowering his profile and mostly avoiding the campaign trail, Mr. Bush gave Republicans a better chance to keep their fire focused on their Democratic opponents. Still, as is customary in midterms, Republicans lost 30 House seats that year. In Mr. Trump's first midterm in 2018, he campaigned extensively and the GOP lost 42 seats. He didn't even have the albatross of an unpopular Middle East war weighing him down. Fewer campaign rallies and more presidential actions that make a meaningful difference in people's lives could produce a better outcome this time. One more 2006 lesson. While the Iraq War was unpopular, 51% in an August 2006 CNN poll still saw Mr. Bush as a strong and decisive leader. He defended his actions, patiently explained the stakes in the war on terror, and was consistent and steady. Some people who didn't like the war still trusted him because they felt, as president, he might know more than they did. By comparison, 62% of Americans characterized Mr. Trump as a strong leader in January 2025, prior to his inauguration. This July, only 43% described him as strong. The problem is messaging. Team Trump should stop the bluster and wild promises on the Iranian conflict, forego crude insults of allies and even foes, and return to the war's original rationale. As Mr. Trump has written on Truth Social, the number one goal is and always will be that Iran cannot have in any way, shape, or form a nuclear weapon. Let him remind people the Iranian leadership has said for nearly a half century, death to America. And with a nuclear arsenal, they could act on that threat. And for God's sake, don't TACO. Trump always chickens out. That would only add to his image as weak, with consequences for domestic politics and the world. I've offered versions of this case for presidential prudence and restraint more times than I can count. That it's ignored doesn't make it any less right. Because there are good Republicans on the ballot who don't deserve to be defeated, but will be unless the president and his advisors forego needless and unhelpful political spectacles this fall. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The young mega socialists are here. Mayor Zoran Mandani displays discounted subsidized bananas. By Emil Barr. 53% of self-identified conservatives under 40 support government-run grocery stores. Not Democrats, conservatives. Take that in. I run a company that tracks layoffs caused by artificial intelligence. And every month I look at spreadsheets that show my generation losing entry-level jobs faster than anyone anticipated. So when the polling says young Americans have soured on capitalism, I'm not surprised by the anger. I am surprised by who is angry. Because the rise of socialism among young Americans is no longer only a Democratic story. Young conservatives who grew up hearing that government was the problem are increasingly asking why the government isn't doing more to make their lives easier, which in 2026 simply means more affordable. They are increasingly comfortable with taxing billionaires, expanding government programs, and blaming some outside group for the sense that the American dream is further away than it was for their parents. The left is embracing socialism openly, but we should worry about how the right is arriving at many of the same conclusions by a different route. In a 2025 survey of young likely voters, 42% of conservatives said they would like to see a Democratic socialist win the presidency in 2028. Among 2024 Trump voters, the figure was 35% in another poll. A March 2026 poll found 77% of all voters support raising taxes on billionaires, including 65% of Republicans, 75% of Independents, and 91% of Democrats. It also found 62% of voters are more likely to back a candidate who supports an increased billionaire tax versus 12% more likely to support a candidate who opposes it. These aren't disciples of Karl Marx, but they believe the economy is rigged against them, and they increasingly believe the government should step in and fix it. A July 2026 Fox News poll found that 61% of Republicans view capitalism favorably, down from 72% in 2019. While the share who feels strongly favorable has fallen from 54% to 41%. The share who say the system is rigged toward the wealthy has climbed from 30% in 2018 to 42%. I'm 23, and I understand why my generation is frustrated. Unaffordable housing is one of the clearest reasons. The striking part of Zoran Mandani's win in New York is that the language he used, affordability, rent regulation, hostility to concentrated wealth, now sounds completely normal to millions of young Americans who would never call themselves socialist. I am not going to tell my generation that everything is fine, but I believe we are making a fundamental mistake when we take a real economic problem and turn it into an argument against capitalism. Capitalism is failing young Americans, but it isn't the reason young Americans are failing. On the left, the villain is usually the billionaire or the corporation. On the right, it might be China, immigrants, Israel, or whichever group is being blamed that month for why we can't afford what our parents could at our age. The targets of blame change, but the logic stays the same. Somebody else took what should have been mine, and whoever it is should pay to give it back. This is where the argument gets uncomfortable. Ask young Americans whether they want universal health care, free college, cheaper housing, or more government assistance, and you will find plenty of support. But when you ask who should pay for it, suddenly the revolutionaries get quieter. We want the Nordic welfare state without the Nordic tax bill. We want the government to spend more money while somehow charging none of us for it, which sounds more like a wish list than an economic model. I think my generation is getting capitalism completely wrong because those of us who are actually building companies are showing that opportunity hasn't disappeared nearly as completely as some young people believe. For the first time on record, 2025 saw Gen Z entrepreneurs starting more new businesses than baby boomers, accounting for 9% of new business starts in 2025 against 5% for boomers. Most of those founders used AI to get started. It has never been cheaper to try to be an entrepreneur. So, which is it? Are we a generation that believes the government needs to rescue us from the economy? Or are we a generation capable of building our own way out? My mother brought me to America from Russia when I was 3 because she believed that her son would have more opportunity here, and she was right. I was able to scale successful businesses as a teenager, negotiate my way through free college, and build a personal net worth of over $20 million all before turning 23. I didn't do that because the government handed me a check, but because America gave me room to try. There are real barriers making opportunity harder to reach, and the government built most of them. Housing supply is restricted by zoning. Licensing keeps capable people out of professions they could otherwise enter. Permitting turns projects that should take months into years-long exercises. If those barriers are making life harder for young people, the answer is to remove them. It isn't to convince an entire generation that capitalism itself is the barrier. Capitalism tells young Americans that the answer is to build something, learn a skill, start a business, take responsibility, and create value. The alternative is to be convinced that every economic problem has an external villain and every solution has to come from Washington. That's a dangerous idea, regardless of which party adopts it. Letter to the editor, Socialism Falls into Anarchy. Peggy Noonan quotes Megan Romer, national co-chair of the DSA, in her responses to questions by interviewer Shannon Breen. Ms. Romer's responses include abolishing the Senate, ICE, borders, and prisons. Add to that replacing the presidency and Supreme Court, along with government or public ownership of most large corporations. Such an agenda constitutes neither socialism nor communism. It's called anarchy. From Robert Tracer, Brooklyn, New York. New topic, North Korea is a U.S. threat. Regarding your editorial, Trump romances Kim Jong-un again. The Defense Department's 2026 National Defense Strategy acknowledges that North Korea's nuclear forces are increasingly capable of threatening the U.S. homeland. President Trump's sudden, inexplicable decision to substantially reduce military exercises with South Korea ignores the danger posed by North Korea. To curtail joint exercises is to retreat from the three visions underscored in the NDS: America first, peace through strength, common sense. From Charles D. Eden, Atlanta, Georgia. This has been the August 20th edition of the Wall Street Journal, read by Corrine. Thank you for listening.